Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona Kay, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And my hope is that the information shared in this podcast will help you understand the strengths, differences, and challenges in your neurodiverse relationship as you move forward in life. Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. Welcome back to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I am really excited for the conversation that I'm going to have today with my guest, Karen Starr Robin, who is a clinical social worker and also is using a model, a therapeutic model that I haven't talked about on the podcast before, called relational life therapy. And many of you may have heard of Terry Real, who developed this model. It's called RLT. And so, Karen, I'm so glad that you're here, and we're going to get to talk about this and so many other things that I think are going to be helpful to our listeners. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here with you, Mona.
Yeah, I'm excited for our conversation. So I'd love if we could start by having you talk a little bit about how you got involved in working with neurodivergent individuals and neurodiverse couples.
Sure. Yeah. How it all started was, I graduated from the University of Maryland School of Social Work in 2000, mm-hmm. and started working in the field, and ended up working for a nonprofit social service agency in the area outside of DC. And I had a client who, at the time, the diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome, which is not a diagnosis in the DSM-5 anymore, but at the time, it was a new diagnosis, a new way of looking at autism. And so I was given a case, a client who was diagnosed with Asperger's, and I worked very closely with him on all kinds of things, including, just everything, relationship stuff, life skills. And he was in college, and I became just really interested in understanding how to be supportive for this person, and then started getting other people on my caseload who had this diagnosis. So I started a group for men who were diagnosed with Asperger's. I'm not sure of this, but I actually think it may have been the first group like that that ever ran. And that's how I started really getting to know the stories of individuals who had this kind of form of autism where, there was, a high level of intellect and maybe some executive function challenges and some social communication issues and really struggling to fit into the world and understand themselves. And then what happened is I started to see children who were diagnosed with maybe Asperger's or at the time called high functioning autism. And I would notice, because I was a family systems trained clinical social worker, that the family systems piece was always something I pursued and something I was fascinated by and something that really felt right to me as a therapist and social worker. Mm-hmm. I would find that these children, they'd come in and maybe they had emotion regulation challenges. Maybe they were having meltdowns, or maybe mom and dad, or maybe the school systems were not quite understanding how to interact with some of these kids. And I realized that as a family systems professional, I could help the system around them, those children, understand the individual better. Mm-hmm. So I could really do more relational work around how do we contextualize this person's experience and their behavior and the way they're operating, the way they're communicating. How do we understand it in a larger system, and how can I help the relationships around this person? Which then did eventually lead to me doing more work, not just with parents, but then, couples work, that more focused on sort of the intimate relationships between people. And then, of course, because I had some experience with working with autistic people, I started to work with neurodiverse couples where maybe autism or ADHD was in the picture in the relationship.
Yeah, it's always interesting for me to learn how folks started doing therapy, counseling, or coaching with neurodiverse couples because, you know, everybody starts differently, but once you kind of get a feel for how much you can assist folks in understanding each other, whether it's in the family system or the couple dynamic, you know, there's so many people, Karen, that are struggling and really, really hurting each other unintentionally. And so when they understand, when we all understand how we're wired neurologically, and we can understand maybe sensory challenges or emotional differences and communication differences, it can be a life changer. So thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah.
And I will add to that one thing that I left out, which is along the way in 2018, after, as I said, I already had a lot of training in family systems work, but then I was introduced to relational life therapy. And when I was introduced to that model and started to really study it, and then I learned actually, Terry Real is the founder and the developer, creator of RLT. He shares all the time that he identifies as someone who has ADHD, which is a type of divergence. I thought it was interesting that he developed a model that it's helpful for lots of couples, but I found it particularly helpful for neurodiverse couples. And that is when I really started working more with couples where there might be neurodivergence in the picture.
That is so interesting because I think a lot of therapists and coaches who are neurodivergent have shared with me that there's a particular model that they feel most comfortable using with their neurodivergent clients or that helped them as they were understanding their neurodivergence. So it's really interesting to hear that Terry is neurodivergent and identifies as ADHD. I do too. And, you know, I know I love the IFS is a model that I really love, and I'm learning more about RLT and we'll learn more through our conversation today. And I think I will explore it more because it might be another model that will work for a lot of folks that listen to the podcast. So thank you so much for sharing kind of how you got to do this work. One of the things that you've done recently with two other folks was to create a workshop called No Ordinary Love. And you were kind enough to send me the link to that. And folks can actually buy access to this workshop. So I'd love to talk about that for a few minutes before we get into talking about RLT, because your workshop was phenomenal, I have to say. And yeah, what made you do that workshop? And kind of, I know it was under Terry's, is it nonprofit or foundation?
Yeah, so, that's under the Relational Life Foundation is a nonprofit arm of the Relational Life Institute.
Okay. And what made you decide to do this workshop you called No Ordinary Love? Was it because of your experience with your clients or what?
Yeah, well, actually what happened was the Relational Life Foundation, I think that was in 2019 or 20, I'm not sure, I can't remember. But it just started, and as they launched it, one of the reasons they wanted to start the foundation was to create a place where marginalized folks who may not have access to therapy that is either costly in time or money, that they could access some RLT, some good relational life skills and training and therapy. And so to launch the foundation, they put out an invitation to people who are training or studying in RLT saying, if you have something to say about relational skills and diversity, equity and inclusion and belonging, we'd like to put together community conversations of panels that come together and talk about a particular topic that fits into DEI&D. And what do you got? What's out there? And so I thought, well, what I do is really about diversity, equity, inclusion, because there's issues of ableism that come up in couples' relationships where neurodiversity is part of that. And so I made a proposal and they accepted it. And then I put together this workshop with my two other panelists. And that's how it happened.
That's awesome. And the two other panelists, one is autistic, and I think the other one identifies as a different type of neurotype. And it's three women, you and the other two, or two people that I think identify as women. I'm not sure if they both do. Mm-hmm. But you also have video clips from a couple that you worked with who shared their experiences. And I will tell you, Karen, that was phenomenal. And very brave of them to share so vulnerably.
Absolutely.
So,
yes.
Yeah. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that, and then we'll talk about RLT.
Sure. No, I mean, thank you, Mona. No Ordinary Love has impacted a lot of people, and I'm grateful for the opportunity, first of all, that the foundation provided. And then the two panelists, Sarah and Libby, they wanted to be in on this. They wanted to create this panel with me. So it was wonderful to have this team of people. In terms of the couple, their names are Brad and Lisa, and they were a couple who I worked with right at the beginning of the lockdown of the pandemic, and I was just kind of really passionate about the relational life therapy work. And so I was working with that work with them, and I was seeing their lives change. I was seeing their relationship change dramatically because of this work. Okay. And so when I worked with Brad and Lisa, I found that they were really, really taking in this work, and it was really making a difference in their relationship. And I worked with them, I don't know, for about a year or so. And then this opportunity came up to do this panel presentation. And I thought, well, I would love it if they could speak to their experience of engaging in this work. And in that particular relationship, Brad had only recently learned of his autism diagnosis about 3 to 6 months before they came to me, and then the pandemic hit. So they had a lot to say. They had a lot that they could share about learning about a diagnosis and later in adult life, what that meant for their relationship, how they initially responded, and each of them responded very differently to learning about the autism diagnosis. And then they were able to really speak to how the relational life therapy work really transformed their relationship and how they even think about relating to one another. So I thought, well, I wonder if they'd be willing to share their story. It's a lot to ask, but I think I'm going to ask them how they feel about that. And when they responded, they said, we would love to be able to help other couples who also have relationships where there is neurodivergence in the picture. And if we can be helpful, we want to share our story. And so that's how that happened.
So, so powerful. And I'm going to recommend to the listeners, we're going to have in the show notes the link for you to purchase this workshop or access to this workshop. I highly recommend it, because if you are a neurodiverse couple, and I've had quite a few neurodiverse couples on the podcast, it's one thing to hear from other couples, and it's another thing also to see the couples talking about their relationship and how it has changed over time. And that's another reason, Karen, that I love doing the Neurodiverse Love couple support groups that I do, because for the first time in many of these couples' lives, they're getting a chance to talk to total strangers, all neurodiverse couples, who they literally could be a fly on the wall of their marriage or relationship. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, so many similarities. So I think it's going to be helpful for folks to be able to watch Brad and Lisa and to hear from you and the other panelists. So I love also that you've been able to use this model with so many neurodiverse couples and those that have wanted to do the work, because I think that's really critical, have been able to transform their relationship. So
Mona,
can
can
we?
I say one thing?
Yes,
Yeah,
absolutely.
I wanted to add one thing because I think this is super, super important. One of the reasons that there's one of the reasons that Brad and Lisa's conversation is so important is because it illustrates it. The neurodiverse couples therapy I do is not about making the neurodiverse person more neurotypical or making the neurotypical person have to make all these changes and accommodations for the neurodiverse person. It's about addressing internalized ableism and also in the relationship and in society that affects the relationship. And that's what No Ordinary Love talks about. It talks about ableism and how that impacts neurodiverse relationships. And sort of that double empathy problem as well. And so I just want to kind of highlight that it's that's an important aspect for me that couples therapy with neurodiverse folks is it's not about making one or the other have to, you know, be better than or worse than the other. It's about helping them learn how to see each other as same as we both have something to contribute to this relationship. And our neurotypes matter, and we just have to understand each other and understand what our limitations are and understand how to maximize our strengths.
Absolutely. And, you know, my mission for neurodiverse love is just that, you know, to partner with others so that we can increase understanding of the strengths, challenges, and differences in neurodiverse relationships. Because in my 30-year marriage, we did not understand those things because we didn't know we were such different neurotypes. And so it created so much unintentional hurt and pain. And, you know, I know that that is something that I'm committed to doing to help educate folks so that we can reduce a lot, hopefully, of that unintentional hurt and pain, whether folks stay together or not. Just I hope more and more couples are willing and open to learn more about themselves and their partner and decide if it's the right relationship for them moving forward. Yeah, so I would love if we could talk a little bit about the relationship grid and the eight lenses that you use in this therapeutic model. So you let me know where you'd like to start on the grid, and then we'll also recommend where folks can get Terry's books to look at the grid themselves and learn more about it.
Sure. Yeah. So the relationship grid is something that Terry developed. It was, you know, it's something he developed over time. And, it's very visual. So it is funny that we're talking about it because it is very visual. So I do encourage people to look it up to get to buy a couple of Terry's books or one or both of them so that you can visually see this. But what I will say, and that's one of the reasons why it's helpful in couples therapy with neurodiverse couples, is because it's a visual representation of self-esteem and boundaries and how. And where each person in the relationship ends up on the grid when they are having their worst day, not when they're having their best day. So the relationship grid is a tool. It's a tool for couples. It's also a tool for the therapist. Sometimes I don't even bring up the relationship grid until I have a solid understanding of where I think each of the partners go on the relationship grid when they are most activated and most at their kind of their worst, most activated selves in relationship to one another. So I say all these things because it's not just a grid that you look at and you say, oh, I go on this part of the grid and that's who I am as a person. That's not what the grid is about. It's about where do you go in terms of your self-esteem and your boundaries when you are at your worst place, having your worst day with your partner, and with the partner that's in your primary relationship with you.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I can say more, but I should probably pause for a minute if you have questions.
No, I think that that's wonderful because I always say, Karen, that where I went so wrong in my marriage, is that I didn't understand about my boundaries. I didn't understand about my nervous system dysregulation. I didn't know how to either co-regulate or regulate myself. And, that absolutely affected my self-esteem. I'm sure it affected my ex-husband's self-esteem. And we had such porous boundaries, if you can even call them boundaries, and codependency galore, And I know so many of the neurodiverse couples that I've met are in similar situations, or they have very rigid boundaries that are more like walls,
That's
Yeah.
right. That's
Yeah.
right. That is exactly the terminology on the grid. So if you were, I'm going to try to paint a picture the best I can. And like I said, I encourage listeners to really look this up so you can visually see it. But if you were looking at the grid, you would see a vertical axis intersecting with a horizontal axis, like a cross, right? And the vertical axis is the axis that represents self-esteem. On the north pole of that vertical axis is grandiosity, and on the south pole of that vertical axis is shame. And right in the center is self-esteem, healthy self-esteem, right? So, because we need to have some self-esteem, but we want it to be, we're working towards healthy self-esteem. So the relationship grid shows that vertical axis, grandiosity and shame. And the horizontal axis is showing the axis for psychological boundaries. And psychological boundaries are, they're not the same as a physical boundary. A physical boundary, we think about how close we're standing to someone. We think about asking consent to touch someone or to be close with them in some way. But a psychological boundary is something internal. And we have a way that we protect ourselves, so we call that the protective boundary. And we have a way that we contain ourselves, we call that the containment boundary. On the grid, what you're going to see on that horizontal axis is all the way over to the left, if you're looking at it. That's called a walled off. That's walled off. All the way over the right is boundaryless. When you were just talking about you and your ex-husband, you said they were, what is the word you used?
Porous.
Porous,
Por
right? That then you probably had some boundarylessness in the way that you would be when you were not at your best selves with each other. Okay, so boundarylessness is over on the right, walled off is over on the left. And what this really means is that when a person in a relationship is activated, is not, effective in the relationship, they might go, if they go to a walled off place, they go to a place where there's withdrawal. It might look like withdrawal. It might look like something like, well, yeah, whatever. I don't want
I
to talk.
would say shut down.
Yep.
It's, I mean, that's a word that a lot of folks use who are in neurodiverse relationships. One or
Right.
both of them shut down, yeah.
Right. It could look like shutdown, and it could sound like, I don't want to talk about this. Or it could sound like literally nothing because the person doesn't say anything, right? Or doesn't convey any idea when there's conflict or some disagreement. So that's more of the walled off side of things. And the boundaryless side of things is the side that where somebody, a person in the relationship might go to a place where there's sort of unbridled expression. Unbridled self-expression, inability to sort of contain some thoughts or ideas, saying things that without thinking about the impact it's having on the other person, or maybe in a neurodivergent sense, maybe not recognizing the impact it may be having on the other person. So that's kind of the more boundaryless place on the horizontal grid. And so when you think about that vertical pole and the horizontal axis, you've got four quadrants now. It's divided into four. So on one side, on the upper side, is walled off and grandiose. We call that walled off and one up. On the other side is boundaryless and one up. On the lower right, called the lower right quadrant, is boundaryless and one down. And the lower left quadrant is walled off and one down.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason that that's important is because when we are in relationship with each other, we are up, and when we're not at our best, when we're activated, when we're not able to manage the emotional activation that's going on in the relationship, somebody might go to a place of, let's say, shame. And shame is thinking to yourself or experiencing yourself as worthless. I don't have any worth because I can't say the right thing. I can't do the right thing. I don't seem to be able to communicate what I'm trying to communicate, whatever it is. But the place that you go internally in your mind and in your body and in your heart is, I'm worthless. That's when you go to the South Pole of the vertical axis into shame.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into that place of shame and you're also desperately trying in relationship with your partner to get them to notice you, to hear you, to listen, to do something the way you want them to do it, or just to do anything to show them that they care, to show you that they care, that's the lower quadrant, boundaryless and one down, desperation. I'll do anything to make you care about me, love me, listen to me, believe me, take me seriously. That's the lower right quadrant. So you might have one person who in relationship, in that primary relationship, their marriage or their partnership or that primary relationship, in that one relationship, they might go to that place, boundaryless and one down, when they're in interaction with their partner, who might, when they are activated, I'm just making this up because it could be any quadrant, might go to the walled off and one up position, the upper left quadrant. That's the quadrant where what's grandiosity? Grandiosity is when you are activated, going to a place internally where you operate like others, in sort of an arrogant way, or others are just not as good as you, not as smart as you, and not as capable of you as you are, and that others are just not as worthy as you are. That's a place of grandiosity that people can go to when they are activated. And maybe they go to that walled off place of shutdown or withdrawal. And so it could look like, it's not even, you're not worth my time. It could also look like, if it were the lower left quadrant, walled off and one down, that would look more like resignation or withdrawal, or just depression, not necessarily like clinical depression, but just depressed, like down and out.
Mm-hmm.
So that could look, that I definitely have neurodiverse couples where the neurodiverse partner, the neurodivergent partner, can go to that walled off and one down place, and their neurotypical partner, not always, but often, is in the boundaryless one up place. So that walled off, that lower left quadrant, walled off and one down. It could be that there's a sense of, I'm always the one who's not getting the cue, or I'm not tuning into my partner the way they want me to. What is wrong with me? I'm just, I'm broken. That's
mm-hmm.
the shame part. And then the walled off is, so I'm just not, I'm going to find something else to do. I'm going to get involved in a project. I'm going to lock myself in my office and get to work for a while. That's that walled off and one down lower left quadrant. Whereas their partner, again, I'm painting a picture of a potential partnership here. It's not all partnerships, but some. Their neurotypical partner might be in that boundaryless one up, that upper right hand corner, more control, more controlling, when they are at their worst, not all the time. And so what would that look like in relationship to their walled off and one down partner? It might look like, what is wrong with you? I'm always the one taking care of everything. I am so tired of being that person. And by the way, you know, I've told you this 100 times and you don't follow through and you don't listen and you don't care about me. And so that is one depiction. There are many depictions. That's one depiction of that boundaryless and one up place that people can go internally, emotionally, and actually act it out with their partner.
So Karen, let's pause here for a second, because as I said earlier, in the couple support groups, so many of the couples say, are you a fly on the wall of our marriage? What you just described is absolutely what went on in my 30-year marriage, to a T. Absolutely. So, you know, I would say, why can't you? Why don't you? Why do you always? Why do you never? I can't believe you're not like this. All my other friends can do whatever, that grandiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And the boundarylessness. I mean, codependent, you know, through the wazoo. And then my ex would say to me, I can never meet your expectations. I will never be enough. I don't know how to meet your expectations anymore. And the shame kind of spiral would begin.
Mm-hmm.
And so literally you just described my marriage. Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of other listeners are saying, she knows us. Yeah. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah. And that's the power of this grid. And I just want to point that out. It's not the magic of Karen Starobin. I mean, maybe a little, but it's the power of the grid that when you can see, when you look at it and you look at the self-esteem and you look at the boundary axis and you try to say, where do I go when I'm really not at my best? Oh, in relationship with this partner, oh, that's where I go. And oh, that's where he goes or she goes or they go. Okay, so then what is the point? How does this grid become useful? Well, then you can see, well, if you want to get closer to the center of health, where do you move? Well, if you're walled off and one down, you have to move a little up and over to the right. You have to get a little bit, you have to work on your boundary becoming a little less rigid, and you have to work on your self-esteem being, you know, raising up a bit so that you can see yourself not as a failure, not as a, you know, a loser, but as somebody who has limitations, perhaps somebody who, you know, needs to work on some skills or needs to communicate differently or needs to receive help from their partner in a different way, but you're not a failure. You're different. You have a different neurotype. You have a different way you navigate in the world, and you need to learn about how that's impacting your partner, how to get up from shame. And if you're boundaryless and one up on the upper right quadrant, you need to move down off that grandiosity a little bit, like come down a bit, same as you want to be no better, no worse than your partner. You've just got some different things that you bring and some different things you take from the partnership. And you want to get a little bit more boundaried, a little bit more contained in what you say and do, recognizing your impact on your partner when you're not contained. Does that make sense? This is not easy.
100%.
Okay.
Not only does it make sense, I know it's going to resonate with a lot of listeners. And also what I love about this is that the lens you're looking through is like when you're at your worst, not when you're at your best, when you're at your worst, where do you fall on this grid? Because I think, and I'm just going to speak from my own experience, if I had been able to articulate to my ex-husband that when I'm at my worst, you are seeing the codependent Mona, the super emotional, you know, and insecure Mona, the Mona who just wants you to say everything's okay and hug me. But I couldn't articulate that because I was so nervous. My nervous system was so dysregulated and I didn't know how to regulate it. And I will tell you, Karen, I run a support group for the non-autistic neurotypical partners. And I've been doing that for, I think, almost 4 years now. And I do 2 a month. And for those that are listening, if you're interested, you can go to my website to learn more about that. They're free. And I've been doing those because I think it's also important for the non-autistic partners to understand that what they're going through is similar to what others are going through, but both partners have to look in the mirror and they have to make a commitment to make some changes. It's
Right.
not one or the other, right?
That's that idea that, you know, Terry Real's work comes from wanting to dismantle patriarchy. That's where it comes from to begin with. So, you know, Terry and I actually haven't had a conversation about this yet, but I suspect he would completely understand what I'm about to say, which is this, that you could say that it not only dismantles patriarchy, which we could talk about in another conversation, but the idea of trying to get to a place in your relationship where you understand you're not better than or worse than the other person. You're same as. That's true in a relationship where there's differently abled, differently wired people. It's not about one being better or worse than. You're same as. You just have you have differences.
Yeah,
So
I
that's,
agree. Yeah, I agree. And I think where we are getting as a society is we are increasing understanding of this, but I think there's so much work that needs to be done. It's almost like a civil rights movement or a like the women's rights movement, but around neurotypes and neurology, because everybody has strengths. And I don't think as a society, we have focused on the strengths of all neurotypes. We've focused on the disorder in the DSM, which I hate, and I wish it was actually differences. And, we all are differently wired. So I so agree with you. So I love that you shared the relationship grid, and you did a great job of explaining all the different quadrants. How, and you did this with Brad and Lisa, so who are in the No Ordinary Love workshop. How do you help couples get to the point where they understand that they have these patterns when they're not at their best, and get them to a point where they can change their patterns and become more resilient? Is there anything that you can share with the listeners that might be helpful?
Sure. I mean, it's a good question, and it could be a 2-hour conversation,
Sure,
but
sure.
we're going to put it, you know, contain that a little bit today. And I do want to just say one other thing though about what you said about disorders and differences, and you know, that's where the neurodiversity movement, the term neurodiversity, came from Judy Singer.
Right.
And that's what she was after, was differently wired is good for the planet. It's good for all of us. There's an ecological value of understanding our relevance as being differently wired and not all wired the same way. So I just wanted to point that out because I think that is the civil rights movement for it's the neurodiversity movement.
Yes, I agree. And actually, Karen, I don't know if I shared this with you. I interviewed Judy Singer, and that episode, that episode will probably have come out before yours. So folks will have heard that conversation. Yeah, she very graciously agreed to talk with me. And so we talk a little bit about that.
So in terms of the what do I do? And I'm a therapist, I'm not a coach. I am a therapist, so I look at things from a therapeutic perspective. As I just want to contextualize this a little bit. As a family systems trained, a relational systems, a relational life therapy trained therapist, we don't pathologize. So we find that the medical model, the DSM-5, is pathologizing. And at the same time, if we're doing the mental health services, we might have to reference the DSM-5 for insurance purposes. But we don't really look at people through that lens, through the medical model. Even before I knew anything about neurodiversity, family systems trained therapists don't pathologize. That's just not how we're trained. So the way that Terry came up with three with eight, I'm sorry, well, there's now eight lenses. You're saying, how do I help people get to this place where they can look at these patterns and see themselves on the grid? Is that we use eight lenses to assess the couple. And okay, so we say in relational life therapy that the client is the pattern that's between the couple that gets them stuck, the pattern that gets them stuck. That's the client, as opposed to One person, the couple, the people are the clients. It's the pattern between the people. We sometimes talk about that being our client. And so we use these eight lenses to figure out this pattern. And so the therapist is using the lenses, but also introducing those lenses to the couple, the clients and the couple. So do you want me to share what each of those lenses are, like what they're called?
I'd love that.
Okay, great. So the lenses are, I'm just going to kind of go through it, and then I'm going to highlight a few of them. So lens one is the presenting problem. So whatever the couple comes in and says, you know, this is what's going on. This is what's really making things difficult or challenging. This is what's bringing us into your office. That's called the presenting problem. That's lens number one. As a therapist, I need to listen to their perspective, each of their perspectives of what the presenting problem is. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Lens two, we call it preconditions. And that's just, that is about looking at, are there other underlying mental health issues or just other underlying conditions, even medical issues that we need to look at when understanding the pattern, when understanding this couple. So we would be looking at, is there neurodivergence? Are there other things? Is there multi-generational trauma? Is there a history of other mental health diagnoses according to the medical model? Anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder. We would be looking at all of that. Lens three is called the latent. So we're trying to figure out, now this is much more for the therapist to be utilizing, and not so much that we talk to the couple about this lens, but the blatant and the latent is when we're meeting the couple, when we're seeing them play out the relational conflict, the relational challenges, which one of them is presenting themselves in a way where their behavior in the relationship is more egregious at the moment. This is a complicated lens because sometimes at the beginning, one partner appears to be blatant and the other more latent. And then as you unravel things, it kind of flips. So just in the beginning, we're looking at what does it, just as things are being presented, what does it seem like in terms of which partner is presenting more of a blatant kind of presentation? And the latent partner is the one who is struggling to have voice, to empower themselves, to give voice, or to give, I guess the best word is voice, to what they need and want in the relationship or to what the problems are. That tends to be more on the latent side. You know, and again, it's not black and white. Everything can be on a spectrum here, but that's what we're looking at. And then the lens four is the losing strategies. I like this lens because the losing strategies are, there's like five losing strategies, and one is unbridled self-expression, one is withdrawal, one is retaliation, one is who's right and who's wrong, and one is the need to be in control. So we're looking at what are the losing strategies that each of these partners are engaging as they're working through their, you know, as they're interacting with each other and as they're describing their interactions. What are the losing strategies they're using? And we will often talk to the couple about what a losing strategy is and ask them to put together what they think their losing strategy profile is for each of them. Mm. Lens five, this is the stance. So this is the more, I'm just going to make this really simple. Like the more Jane pursues or goes after or attacks or presses in or needs, the more her partner withdraws or shuts down, the more her partner shuts down, the more she pursues and presses in and needs and needs and needs. That's called the stance, stance, stance. And you're looking for, the therapist is looking for, what is a pattern of relating here? The more this person does this, the more this person does that. The more this person goes here, the more that person goes there. That's called the stance, stance, stance. The lens six is the relationship grid. And lens seven is family of origin, which is really looking at, in RLT terms, what we're doing with family of origin is we're looking at where did each partner, how did each partner come to have the reactions that they have in their relationship? How did that come to be? Like, so we might ask a person, where do you think you learned that in order to get your needs met, you had to really make a lot of noise about it? And so this is where, I'll get back to the neurodivergence piece in a minute. So this is about your system you grew up in, and mm-hmm. where did you learn that in order to be okay, you had to make sure you didn't talk about emotions? Where did you learn that? That's family of origin work. And then we'll get into the narrative of, well, I learned that from, you know, my mom or dad, or when I grew up in a house where we couldn't talk about feelings, or, you know, no one ever, I have a client who's like, yeah, I mean, we just, like, there was no, like, emotions were not part of we just didn't talk about emotions at all. And so that's family of origin. But lens eight is the sociocultural lens. That's where the neurodivergence piece comes in too, though. That's where I work on, okay, what's our neurodiverse profile for each of you? And I just have a system of that I do to go through that. So that we can take a look at that. When you're thinking of all these as lenses, each one is a way you can see the couple in a different way and gives you information about the couple and the dynamic and the patterns between them, including their neurodiverse profile. Those are the eight lenses, and very much in a nutshell.
Love it, love it, love it. And if any of the listeners are interested in getting more information about the relationship grid and these eight lenses, which of Terry's books would you recommend?
Well, I definitely think The New Rules of Marriage by Terry is a great book to just get the, really, honestly, it's just perfect to get the basics of his model. But I also think the book Us is a fantastic book that definitely you're going to learn about the model. And you're also going to hear stories that describe couples' relationships and how what kinds of data he gathers from using these lenses. But you hear more of it in terms of a storytelling kind of style with Us.
I love it. Well, I mean, the amount of information that you've shared in a short time, I know is going to be helpful. And those folks that are in your area, they may be reaching out to you. You're in Maryland, but you can do therapy in Maryland and DC. Is that correct? Or did I get that wrong? Yeah.
Yeah. Myself and I have an incredible team of associates who we're all, most of us are licensed in Maryland and DC. One of us is also licensed in Virginia. We are not all RLT certified, and we don't all do couples work, but another therapist in my practice who does do couples work, she's also training in RLT. So yeah, we can do work in Maryland and DC. One of my therapists who does couples work is actually also licensed in Texas and Louisiana.
Wonderful. Well, I think that this model, I have to do more research because I think that this model is going to be so helpful to a lot of folks. And I know some of the couples that have come to my support groups have gone to RLT trained therapists, but I hadn't done a lot of research on it. So I'm so glad that you and I had an opportunity to meet and talk about it. I want to talk about one more thing before we close out, and that is the grief that so many couples come into my support groups feeling. And the grief is oftentimes very different for both partners. And, you know, one partner is thinking the relationship, the marriage that I thought I was going to have is very different than, I dreamed of or thought of. And now I understand why. And the other partner, who may be recently self-identified as neurodivergent or autistic, and also, or may have gotten an official diagnosis, is oftentimes grieving for the life they could have had as an individual and the life that they could have had in their relationship if they had understood and known their neurotype. And, there's all kinds of things that are going on in the grieving process. And I always start with that with the neurodiverse couples because I want people to understand that this is real. Is there anything that you would like to share? Because I'm sure you have couples going through this. Anything that you would like to share about this that you think might be helpful to folks?
Yeah, Mona, that is, I think, one of the most important parts of working with any couples and especially neurodiverse couples. I talk about, I'll just say this briefly. Let me know if I'm going on a little too long. I'm going to try to make this brief, but this idea of markers of resilience, where I notice that neurodiverse couples who do better are able to get to a place, if they're not already there, they can get to a place where they accept that there are limitations in their partner, and that they, but that both partners can accept those limitations in each other, and that they are able to grieve the losses of what they hoped and expected to have in their relationship that are not going to be there or not going to be there in the way that they had expected or hoped. When couples are able to get around to get to that level of acceptance and to grieve, really talk about it, process it, really own it, they are often couples who do better in the relationship, who have a better sort of, for lack of a better word, prognosis. And the grieving part is what I notice and what I help people do is really just recognize that in a relationship, we come with expectations. We often want our partners. This is very just typical for all relationships. We want our partners to kind of heal that wound that we come in, that we have from wherever, from trauma, traumatic experiences, from childhood experiences, from not getting what we needed at some point in our lives in a relationship. And when our partner isn't able to do that, we need to grieve that. And also we need to learn that our partner, no partner can do that. No partner can do that. And so we have to grieve these expectations that we think that we, that we had going into the relationship. And that takes it takes time, it takes skill from a therapist to help each partner really name what it is that maybe they had hoped for that they're not going to get in the way they thought, and really let go without resentment. So we talk about in RLT grief work about being able to recognize what it is that you're grieving and live with that grief, without resentment. If resentment's there, then you're not, you haven't actually done the grief work.
That is so vitally important. And, I don't think I've talked about this on the podcast, but it just came to me and I want to share it. I think that it took me 2 years after my divorce, and I've been divorced almost 6 years, so it was 2018. It took me 2 years of therapy, of, going inside my soul and my spirit. And, this was after a 32-year relationship, 30-year marriage, to really let go of the resentment I had towards my ex-husband. And the resentment came from, and I really want to stress this because I think it's going to hit hard for a lot of folks. The resentment came from him deciding that he no longer wanted to do any work with me. and could walk away from our 30-year marriage. And even saying that out loud now, if you had talked to me 6 years ago, I would have been crying hysterically, right? And I see people in my support group that I have for the neurotypical and the non-autistic folks literally break down when they start talking about how could my partner walk away? How could they not be willing to do the work after all these years that we've spent with each other? But if we can't accept that our partner may not be able to do the work we want them to do, or they may decide they don't want to do the work that we're asking of them to do to be the best, most, authentic person they can be. And we hold on to that resentment, Karen. I know that I would have been physically ill if I had held on to it. And I know my mental health would have gone down the tubes. Yeah.
That's right.
So I want to share that with listeners because there's so many people out there, I'm sure, both of all neurotypes that are holding on to that resentment. Why do you have to be so emotional? Why can't you just accept that logically this is what it is and move on? Or why do you have to process everything in depth and we have to talk about every single issue? There's so many different perceptions that we all have as being right. But the fact of the matter is, and I say this often, the Gottmans, who've done a lot of research with couples, they say 69% of our problems are perpetual problems that are not going to get resolved.
That's
And
right.
so, right? So if we keep focusing on those perpetual problems, not only are we going to be resentful, we're going to be judgmental, we're going to be, accusatory, we're going to probably have a lot of contempt for our partner, and it's not going to be healthy for anybody. So I
And that gets right to it, and you won't live a relational life. I mean, what we're talking about here is a kind of a relational mindfulness that to be relational is to find the nuanced, to move from the more rigid black and white, perfectionistic, harsh, certain tightness in body place to a more nuanced, forgiving, flexible, yielding, humble, relaxed place, both in your body and in your mind. And while I say that, I know that some neurotypes, there is some, black and white thinking or perfectionistic tendencies. So it's not to say that that isn't something that can be worked with, but it is needing to be understood how that impacts the other partner, how that other partner can bring a more flexible self to maybe a more black and white thinker. But being relational means to be able to be more yielding and less rigid and more generous. And so it takes a lot of work to get to that place when you're in a relational problem with your partner. But that's what we're working towards, is just more respectful relational living with each other.
Yeah. And when it happens, it is so beautiful. It really is. And it's empowering and it gives you life and it makes you feel, secure and safe with your partner. And it is definitely very different than what maybe a lot of couples are feeling right now because they're not in that space, in that place. So, Karen, again, this has been a phenomenal conversation. I am so glad that we've had a chance to meet and talk. Is there anything else that you want to share with the listeners before you provide your contact information? Anything we haven't talked about that you want to share in the last few minutes?
I think, I mean, again, yes, I agree that this has been a really great conversation. And there's, I feel like I want to say that there's a lot of complexity here. And I really hope that people will understand that none of this is simple or simplistic. That these lenses and this grid, these are tools to help us be able to look, to see something we couldn't see before, and then to see it, and then to say to ourselves, well, what can we do differently, or what, how can I understand myself differently because I see this now? How can I understand my relationship differently because I see something differently now? So it's very complex, and I want to underscore that there's a lot of complexity in trying to learn how to be more relational, how to develop relational skills, and how to be in connection, to be protected emotionally and connected at the same time.
Yeah.
It's complex. It's not simple.
Right. And at the beginning, you said that you worked with Brad and Lisa, who are the couple in the No Ordinary Love workshop. You worked with them for a year. So I would say to those couples that are interested in working with you or another RLT trained therapist, know that, you know, you can, I'm going to say this because this is what's coming to me. You can invest in yourself and your partner by choosing a therapist who has expertise in this model or another model that works for you and invest in that, or you can invest in a divorce attorney, you know, and, you know, divide your assets up. So, you know, it's a choice. It's absolutely a choice that we all make, you know, do we want to invest in our relationship or do we want to move on from the relationship and, you know, hire a mediator or a divorce attorney. But yeah.
I will also say that in what we say in the work that we do in RLT is we help people come to a place where they look at what's called relational reckoning. Mm. Am I getting enough in the relationship that I can grieve the loss of what I'm not getting? Am I getting enough in the relationship where I can grieve the losses of what I'm not getting without resentment? That's called relational reckoning. Because if you're looking to get everything out of the relationship that you expected and wanted and think you deserve, you know, no one gets that.
No, absolutely. That's a great way to end this, because I think in every relationship, there are limitations. And if we can't accept the limitations and we think we're going to get every need and every preference and every want that we have in our relationship with our most intimate partner met, we're in for a lot of suffering and anger and a lot of other negative feelings. So I agree 100%. But, you know, everybody has their own journey. And I think you have done a fabulous job of explaining some of the core principles of this model. And for those folks that want to work with you or any of the other therapists in your practice, what is the best place for them to find you and to reach out?
Yeah, they should go to starobincounseling.com and you will get to see, you know, bios and information about all of us. We all are, you know, I use the term neurodiversity affirming, but we all do some type of neurodiversity affirming work. Some of us do couples work. Some of us do parenting work. Some of us work with children and families. But that's where you should go, starobincounseling.com.
Wonderful. And I'll put that in the show notes. I'll also put in the show notes the link to the No Ordinary Love workshop, which I want to say it was at $49. Karen, do you remember?
Yeah, that's. I believe that's right. It's a suggested donation of $49. And if anybody wants to see it and they truly aren't able to, you know, pay $49 and you contact the Relational Life Foundation, they'll make sure you have access to the link.
Wonderful.
But just know, I want to make clear, I don't get any proceeds from that. That all goes back to the foundation so that the foundation can provide workshops on relational skills for people who may not typically have access to that kind of work.
Which I think is wonderful, because I hear this often from couples and individuals. You know, they ask if I do scholarships, I do two free support groups, because I know there are a lot of folks that can't afford to get the support they need. And I know there are other organizations that do free workshops and support groups. And I think, you know, I wish therapy was free for everybody. It's never going to happen. So I love that the foundation is offering this to folks that need it and might not be able to access it financially. So Karen, thank you again. I've really, really enjoyed this conversation, and I know it's going to be helpful to a lot of folks. So I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to share both your expertise and the experiences that you've had with some of your couples, and to shed a light on RLT, which I have not discussed on the podcast before. So thank you.
Thank you, Mona. Thanks for just having this conversation with me. It's been fabulous. Thanks.
I agree. Thank you.